Thank you. Quite short. Thank you. In 1954, the novelist Douglas Wallop came out with a nifty little piece of fiction titled The Year the Yankees Lost the Pennant. Since 2010 is also just such a year with the World Series in full swing, I figured I'd lead off with it, especially since one of the two central characters in this novel is indeed the devil. And yes, I know the Yankees came closer to the pennant than the Red Sox did this year, but never mind. Wallop's book, which I believe is still in print, is one of a number of literary variations on the theme of Goethe's tragedy, Faust. In this early 19th century dramatic version of a much older German legend, Goethe's Faust sells his soul to the devil in exchange for infinite knowledge. In Wallop's novel, the deal made with the devil is for a somewhat less lofty but still quite noble goal, which is that of an American League pennant for the old Washington Senators baseball team, a franchise now long gone. If this all sounds vaguely familiar, the novel was the basis for the Broadway musical and subsequent movie, Damn Yankees, which is not an unknown sentiment in these parts. This is the musical that gave us such numbers as You Gotta Have Heart and Whatever Lola Wants, Lola Gets. They ever done that here in Nashville, by the way? Never tried that.
The show? Yes.
Yeah, all right. So you guys know, some of you know about it. And the story, brief as I can make it here, is as follows. It's a mid-1950s American summer. By July, the Yankees are already running away with the American League, with the league lead, with the hapless Washington Senators mired where they usually are in last place. Joe Boyd, who is a middle-aged real estate salesman, is also a long-suffering Senators fan. After listening to yet another Senators loss on the radio, he takes a walk around the block in his neighborhood where he lives with his wife, Meg, muttering to himself about how he would sell his soul to the devil if the Senators could just get a good long ball hitter that would carry his team to an American League pennant. Well, right on cue, the devil shows up in the person of a Mr. Applegate. He was this kind of shadowy, con man, generally shifty sort of a guy who's always sort of moving in and out of the shadows somewhere. And Applegate offers his deal. He'll turn middle-aged couch potato Joe Boyd into 20-year-old stud Joe Hardy and endow him with the best baseball skills any human being ever had in exchange for his soul. Boyd, soon to be Hardy, takes the deal, but negotiates an escape clause for himself. He can get out of the deal anytime up until 9 p.m. on September 25th, which is the last day of the regular season. This was before there were playoffs. He went straight to the World Series as soon as the regular season ended, thereby avoiding playing baseball in the cold and sometimes snows of November and not bumping it right into Halloween, but I digress. The deal goes forward. Joe Boyd becomes Joe Hardy, gets himself onto the Senators, carries his team up through the standings in pursuit of the Yankees. There are several subplots in this story I can't get into in any detail. They had to do with Joe's true identity becoming an object of media attention, which gets the song Shoeless Joe from Hannibal Moe. It also, he comes under the spell of the seductive Lola. He longs for his wife, Meg, who has reported him as a missing person. In order to keep Meg in the storyline, Joe Hardy rents a room in her house, his old Joe Boyd room, so he can still be in contact with her even though she doesn't know who he is. Pulling the strings behind all these machinations is our good old boy and good old devil, Mr. Applegate. Well, the story wouldn't be a story if it didn't all come down to September 25th, which of course it does. Senators and Yankees end up tied for first place with this one last game to go. Now, the book and the play and the movie had two different endings, each with the same outcome. In both versions, it's a few minutes before 9 o'clock. The game, of course, is in the ninth inning. The score, of course, is tied. Joe yells to Applegate, who's sitting in the front row behind the Senator's dugout, that he wants out of the deal as soon as 9 o'clock arrives. In the play in the movie, Joe is at bat with two strikes on him. When the hour of 9 comes, he becomes Joe Boyd again while standing at the plate, but still manages to muster up enough of whatever he has in him to hit a home run, his game-winning, pennant-winning home run. Well, I like the book version a little better. In this one, Joe's on base, representing the winning run. And from the base he's occupying, he yells to Applegate that he wants out of the deal. The batter at the plate gets a hit. And precisely at 9 p.m., as Joe Hardy is rounding third base, he becomes Joe Boyd. He still somehow manages to huff and puff his middle-aged body down the third baseline, slide safely home, beating the Yankees and thereby beating the devil. In the denouement, Joe goes back to being Joe Boyd. He goes back to his wife, Meg. Applegate shows up and tries to get him to go back to being Joe Hardy just one more time for the World Series, but which also allows the devil to reclaim Joe's soul. Joe refuses, choosing to stay with his wife. Middle-aged real estate guy, Joe Boyd, love, commitment, and dedication went out. Overall, the devil can muster. The curtain falls, everybody applauds and goes, ah, and that's that. Well, it's all good and fun. Maybe, even if one is a Yankees fan. In this case, it's also a lighthearted reminder of what an enduring image the person of the devil is in our society and culture. And while in this whimsical tale, the setting is a baseball field, it is reflective of a larger cosmic view, primarily in the West, that our individual lives, as well as the life of our world, are being played out on some kind of a cosmic ball field or cosmic battlefield, where the forces of good and the forces of Satan are contending for the upper hand, with each trying to gain as many human recruits or souls as they can to do their bidding so they can each accomplish their ends. This image theme also, and if you've seen this one, shows up in one of the Star Wars movies, where the devil, in this case Darth Vader, informs the virtuous Luke Skywalker that he, Luke, is really his son and urges him to come on over to the dark side. The not-so-subtle message is that we're all susceptible, having something of the devil in each of us, to go over to the forces of evil, that is to say, to the devil's domain. Well, just exactly when this worldview began to take shape is difficult to determine. In the Western world, it goes back at least, probably before, but at least to the Zoroastrian religion of ancient Persia, which was flourishing some 6 centuries before the Christian era. In this place and time, the world was seen again as a battlefield between the forces of light, led by the god Ahriman, and the god is Ahura Mazda, the prince of darkness is Ahriman. Many of the images of God and the devil that can be found in Judaic and Christian faiths are reflective of this Zoroastrian influence. This was the religion to which the ancient Hebrews were exposed the time of the Babylonian captivity, as I said, some 6 centuries before the Common Era, which we are now 2,000 years into. Well, that might help explain how we got some of our images of the devil. It still begs the larger question of why these images and why belief in the devil persists. And persist it does. About 3 years ago, the results of a Harris poll, very reliable polling organizations, revealed that 62% of Americans believe in the devil and in hell. Now, the devil, in this survey anyway, didn't do quite as well as God, who had a 20-point lead on him. He had 82% level of belief in God, only 62% with the devil. But old Satan still, in this survey, managed to outpace Darwin's theory of evolution, in which only 42% of those surveyed said they believed in it. I really do not know what to make of the fact that these numbers are correct, that we live in a society where the devil has better cred than Darwin, but there it is. Probably another sermon that set of numbers alone, but this one isn't it. I think the deeper issue here is really the age-old issue of how we human beings come to terms with the reality of evil and to whom or to what we attribute it. I go back several years on this point to an article that ran in Newsweek magazine as the 20th century was coming to an end. If you remember then, right about that time, any number of wrap-up-the-century pieces were being written in all kinds of magazines, kind of recap both the 20th century as well as the whole millennium. And after citing some of the really horrible events of the 20th century, things like the Holocaust, like ethnic cleansing types of genocides, mass starvations here and there that didn't have to happen, all those kinds of things, the article ended on this note. Wherever we turn, the century now drawing to a close has witnessed evil on a scale unmatched by any other. In an earlier America, evidence such as this would have immediately evoked a name, a face, an explanation. Satan's powerful domination over a fallen, sinful humanity. Today, evil is experienced as random and ordinary, devoid of cosmic significance. Kind of got in a little argument there with, not in person, of course, but whoever wrote this, because I took the words in general to be true, but I wasn't sure I bought the last line. I think the persistence of the image of the devil in some form or other is because there is a part of us that cannot accept the idea of evil as, quote, random and ordinary and devoid of cosmic significance. When we witness events as breathtakingly horrifying as the Holocaust, or ethnic cleansing, or mass starvation, sometimes brought on by despotic rulers, or any number of acts of terrorism, we cannot help but feel, somewhere beyond, maybe beyond our rational thought, we cannot help but feel that maybe there's something bigger going on here than that of human beings behaving in horribly bad ways towards other human beings. And it need not be a world-shaking event to bring on some thoughts. Sometimes it gets very close to home. I know a trial here in Nashville is currently in progress, and I should not, will not, presume the outcome with respect to who may be convicted of what. But the heinous deed of nearly a year ago that precipitated this trial is not in question. The brutal murder of a woman and near murder of her daughter in what they assumed was their safe and secure home, and the mind-numbingly vicious way in which this horrible act was carried out. It is quite literally mind-numbing. It leaves one grasping for an explanation, for no rational one exists. And for some, perhaps, the only way to articulate such overwhelmed feelings, whether it is in the wake of a global or a local occurrence, is to speak of someone or something called the devil, even if one cannot say for sure just who or what that devil is. In fact, I wonder how many of those 62% responders to the Harris poll who said they believed in the devil, I have to wonder if some of them anyway, were maybe really searching for some greater cosmic explanation for the unspeakably terrible and human-generated deeds that defy any kind of rational explanation. And I'm not sure, speaking for myself now, just how I would have responded if the Harris Poll people had approached me in their survey. It would have been, for me, a bit complicated. Now, if the question was just asked straight out, do I believe in an actual literal creature or being called Satan or the devil or Lucifer or whatever other name might be used, and who is the ultimate source of all evil, then my answer is a flat out no. I do believe, whether such can be fully explained or not, knowing often that it cannot be, I do believe that human beings are at the heart of all human evil, just as I believe that human beings are at the heart of all human good. I believe that's called humanism. But here's my caveat. I'm also aware that human language often fails us, sometimes comes up short on the literal level. On some other level, we seem to need some way to give voice and meaning to that which we but vaguely apprehend, as the words to one of our hymns puts it. So as a metaphor for ungraspable evil, if pushed, I guess I would say the devil works as well for me as anything, just as the term God works as well for me as anything when it comes to naming that which is greater than we know and which we cannot fully grasp or adequately name. Now, I would guess, if I were to attempt to explain all that to a pollster who came my way, he or she would probably look at me funny and move on, figuring they'd be better off finding someone else who could at least give them a straight answer. These kinds of yes-no polls don't leave much room for nuance or for much deliberative thought, for that matter. But let's try that. Let's pick up for a few minutes on this metaphorical as opposed to liberal take on the devil. And in doing so, I take a cue from my now departed colleague, ministerial colleague and friend, the Reverend Forrest Church, in one of a number of books he published on liberal religion in his too short of a lifetime. This book, I pulled it off my shelf here, is in fact called The Devil and Dr. Church. Got this nifty little devil imagery on the image on the cover there. It's a good little book. The key line in it, the one that sort of jumped out at me above all others, is where Forrest wrote, "The devil's trademark is not evil dressed as evil, but evil dressed as good. The devil's most successful ruse is to cloak himself in virtue." That has some overtones of the piece Harry read a little earlier. And what I believe Forrest is saying is that not everyone, perhaps only a few people, set out to commit evil thinking they're doing an evil deed. Some of the most terrible deeds human beings have done to one another are those that have been, to use Forrest's words, cloaked in virtue. In order for evil to be perpetrated, or if you will, for the devil to do his work, a sense of unquestioned rightness needs, or virtue needs to prevail on the part of those who are doing it. Such a sense of rightness may prevail only in the mind of a single individual, or it could be within a close circle of individuals as a function of groupthink, probably the way a terrorist cell operates, or it can be found within the mentality of a culture itself. Another caveat. Reverend Church's insight, valuable as it is, does not adequately get at the kinds of horrific and seemingly random acts of violence, such as the one I referred to earlier and that is now before a local court of law. We'll probably never know the nature of the demons residing deep in the souls of those who committed such wanton acts. But Forrest's words, even with their shortcomings, still go a long way in pointing to the source of much of the needless destruction and hatred and death that we human beings have foisted upon one another during our time on this planet. Think of all the wars that have been fought because one or the other or both sides thought they were doing the will of God, cloaked in virtue, that is to say. Think of all of those who were tortured and or put to death in various kinds of inquisitions that were being carried out by those who truly felt they were being virtuous by enforcing the alleged correct religious beliefs. I refer again to the book I cited 2 weeks ago, Terror in the Name of God, in which Dr. Jessica Stern hauntingly demonstrates how those from Al-Qaeda operatives to persons who bomb abortion clinics all did and do what they fully believe they are doing in the service of righteousness. Again, cloaked in virtue. Or maybe on a less, but still very serious level, I wonder if those who inveigh so strongly on religious grounds against gay, lesbian, bisexual persons are really aware of the harm they are doing in the service of what they truly believe is a virtuous and righteous cause. Cloaked in virtue, but still perpetuating a sometimes deadly stigma that continues to rear its head, as we've recently seen in the wake of a number of suicides of gay persons, especially teenagers, who were the subjects of intense ridicule and scorn. Forrest Church may not have completely hit the nail on the head, but he still nailed it pretty well. The devil's trademark is not evil dressed as evil, but evil dressed as good. Well, this is not the kind of note, though, on which to end. For it is the responses of the human spirit, of what Abraham Lincoln, invoking yet another and more positive metaphor, called the better angels of our nature. It is that response in the face of the deeds of evil, or deeds of the devil, if you will, that offer a saving grace. I am still moved by a piece the late actor Kirk Douglas wrote on the op-ed page of the New York Times some 15 years ago. You remember Kirk Douglas. The most memorable film character he ever gave us was Spartacus. Well, in this piece, written not too long before he passed away, Kirk Douglas told of being in Berlin to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award and of his mixed feelings, being a person of the Jewish faith, about being there given that city's history within his own lifetime. But then he told about how on this same trip, he and his wife had dinner with a Jewish woman in Berlin whose parents and grandparents had died in the death camps. Mr. Douglas asked his hostess why she had stayed in Berlin over the ensuing course of her life once the war was over. And this is how he, Mr. Douglas, described the conversation that followed. Smiling, she gave me this answer. "I owe it to the little heroes." "I don't understand," I said. With a sigh, she came over and sat closer. When the Gestapo came to get them, my parents sent me to a small hotel to save my life. The owner was the first little hero. She kept me safe for a couple of nights. When it became dangerous, I met my second little hero, or should I say heroine. She was our former housekeeper. She hid me for a while and endangered her own life. Then I found a cloister. My little heroes were nuns who took care of me when I was very sick. They never asked questions. When my situation again became dangerous, my next little hero was a policeman who didn't agree with the Nazis. All through the war, I was lucky to find little heroes who helped me until the Russians came in. I've stayed in Berlin because I feel I owe it to the little heroes who helped me. Not everyone here was wicked. Mr. Douglas then concluded. Her story had a great impact on me. Of course, we're always looking for a big hero to emulate, and often we see them topple from clay feet. How much better to reach for the little heroes in life and try to be one. The rise and onslaught of Nazism was among the greater evils of the previous century, an evil cloaked in the so-called good or the so-called virtue of creating a master race of white Aryans. It still stands as a stark and scary example of how the forces of evil can almost overwhelm an entire society and culture. But as Kirk Douglas' story demonstrates, the operative word there is almost. Not everyone was wicked, as one of the survivors of the era noted. I doubt that those who came to the aid of that woman when she was then a young girl and who ended up telling her story to Kirk Douglas thought of themselves as heroes or heroines. They probably just saw themselves as ordinary people who found themselves living in an extraordinary time and who were simply trying to do the right thing. I think this is what ultimately keeps evil, or the devil, so to speak, from having the final word. It's people who do the right thing at the right time in the face of whatever inhumane deeds, whatever kind of humanity, inhumanity, is being perpetrated. People who can still see the essential humanity in the eyes and faces and hearts of their fellow human beings when their humanity is being denied or diminished and respond accordingly. And that gets us to our mission here. We're called to be a community that affirms the inherent worth and dignity of every person. One that seeks the attainment of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. May we keep these ideals ever before us and strive to see them fulfilled to the extent that is humanly possible. We know that few ideals are ever fully completed. Few ideals are ever completely fulfilled. But we know also that the failure to try is to give the devil more than his due. On that note, let's sing our closing hymn. It's "Love Will Guide Us." It's number 131, by the way, not the 31 in order of service. Number 131. Love Will Guide Us.